Hello and welcome to the Safe Food Nutrition Podcast. I'm Dr. Aileen McGloin, Director of Marketing and Communications at Safe Food, the all-island agency promoting food safety and healthy eating. On this podcast, we talk about nutrition, issues like obesity, food poverty, sustainability, and health in the media. Today, we look at the marketing of unhealthy food to children with emphasis on digital media. We'll examine the evidence on the extent and impact of marketing of unhealthy food to children, as well as how it's currently being tackled in the UK and Republic of Ireland. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Mimi Tatlow-Golden, Senior Lecturer in Developmental Psychology and Childhood at the Open University, where she also co-chairs the Centre for Children and Young People's Wellbeing. One of Mimi's key research areas is digital food marketing and rights. She works extensively with NGOs on these issues, including the WHO and UNICEF globally, as well as the Irish Heart Foundation. I'm also joined by Head of Advocacy at the Irish Heart Foundation, Mr. Chris Macy. The Irish Heart Foundation has played a strong advocacy role on this topic of marketing of food to children in recent years. Their Stop Targeting Kids campaign supports parents and enlists public support for stricter controls at government level. Welcome, everybody. Mimi, I'm going to start with you, if you don't mind. What evidence do we have of the extent and impact of the marketing of unhealthy food to children?
So, you know, we've got decades of evidence at this point, really strong evidence from decades of research studies starting in the 1970s, consistently coming through to now. Lots of meta-analyses, so where people pool the results of different studies and look to see, are all the findings trending in one way? And if you group the findings together, are they still showing the same thing? And consistently, what the evidence shows, and WHO, the World Health Organization, and even the World Health Assembly has voted on this, it's quite straightforward. Food marketing changes what children want and do. So it changes their attitudes to foods, it changes what they want to eat, their preferences, it changes what they ask their parents to buy, it influences what they buy themselves as they get pocket money, and it influences what they eat. And it spans all kinds of studies, experiments, studies of the looking at the stories that ads tell and the characters they use, what appeals to children, and brought together. The evidence is so strong that over a decade ago, so in 2010, the WHO said, the evidence is already really strong. We need to ask all states to pull back on advertising these foods to children.
And Mimi, can we draw a direct link then between childhood obesity and the advertising of unhealthy food to children?
So it's a good question, because it depends what you mean by a direct link. So can you construct a study in which you give half the children a world in which they have no exposure to food marketing and the other half lots of exposure to food marketing and see whether some become obese and others don't? You can't do that. That's completely unethical. And we can't create such a world anyway, right? But what we can do is understand that the behaviors that flow from exposure to marketing and that are consistently demonstrated show consistently that that children eat more. And not only do they eat more after viewing ads immediately or in general in their lives, but they don't compensate for that eating later on in the day, say. So they don't sort of have an extra snack and then eat less at dinner. They just eat a little bit more. And one really interesting study in Australia that came out a couple of years ago did a study in a children's camp. So they had the children in a really naturalistic setting, sort of doing what they were doing anyway. And here they were able to come closer than anyone else has come to a controlled study where half of the kids watched TV and had exposure to some digital marketing that included food, and the other half didn't. And the kids who were in the food exposure group daily ate about 40-ish calories extra. And if you think about it, that is enough. If that adds up over days, weeks, months, and years, that's enough to tip you into overweight and ultimately obesity over time. So we can draw a link between marketing of unhealthy food to children and obesity. But the important thing to bear in mind is that we can't say that marketing is the one and only thing that causes children to you know, become overweight or to experience obesity, because in the end, what we're living in is a system in which children are completely surrounded by cues to consume, to like, to want, to ask for, to eat unhealthy foods more than healthy foods. And it's that entire system in which marketing is a big part that we have to tackle.
Chris, if I could come to you, bring you in at this point, do you think the public is aware of the kind of impact that Mimi has described of marketing of food to children?
I think there's certainly some awareness of the impact, and that's highlighted, for example, in the fact that I think it's 71% of people supported an outright ban on junk food marketing to children in a poll that was carried out for the Irish Heart Foundation. And even higher numbers supported a ban on things like celebrity endorsements, junk ads in games, apps for children, that sort of thing. On those figures, you could say that the public is well ahead of policymakers on the issue. Now, having said that, I don't think people are fully aware of children's exposure to junk food advertising and therefore, I suppose, to its impact. I think most people are shocked when you tell them, for example, about Mimi's research showing 4 and 5 year old kids still seeing 1,000 junk food ads on television a year, despite restrictions to broadcast advertising. They're also shocked, you know, by other findings, research findings on impact. You know, one that caused a few ripples not so long ago was UK research showing that, you know, just seeing one extra junk food ad a week on TV would add around 18,000 extra calories to a child's annual diet, which we were told is the equivalent of 60 cheeseburgers and will add 5 pounds to a child's weight. So that's pretty significant, but that's just television. You know, because digital marketing is more personalized, it's therefore more effective and then more damaging than the sort of the blunt instrument of TV ads, where the same message goes to you whether you're 8 or 80 and whether you're interested in pizza or fine dining. So I think people have started to understand what marketers are capable of since the Cambridge Analytica affair and all those terms like psychographic micro-targeting came to the fore. But, you know, I don't think most people or indeed politicians quite grasp what the power that online marketers have over children.
Do you think that parents are any more aware than other segments of society?
We have a parents group who help campaign with us and put in complaints to regulators and that sort of thing. They're certainly very aware. You know, as a parent myself, I think if I wasn't working for the Irish Heart Foundation, I wouldn't know what my children are doing. I don't know what my children are doing on their smartphones, for example. So I don't think I'd have much idea of what's happening. So I think generally no. And again, Mimi did some research for us some years ago that showed parents were quite blasé initially about the impact that online advertising would be having on their children. But when they were showed the tactics, I think then parents tended to get a little bit angry about it, all right. And, you know, I think there was an informative process just in that piece of research that showed that.
And I'm going to come back again to you, Mimi, just to ask you, how do young people and children respond to the ads themselves when they see them online?
Oh, yes, good question. And before I get into that, I am going to say, just to add to what Chris was saying there, that research with the parents in Ireland, which I did across the country. And it was really interesting to go through the process with them of starting off asking them, you know, is food advertising in social media a thing that you think about in terms of your teens? These were parents of 13-year-olds and they were saying, oh, no, not really. And, you know, some of them were saying, well, there are other things I'm worried about. And some of them were saying, well, they're sensible, you know, they know how to make their own decisions now. And in general, there was a sense of it's just not on my radar. And also, you know, a certain really understandable sense of I have got enough to be worrying about. So what I did then was show them examples of the food advertising, as Chris was saying, you know, linked into the celebrities that they love, the YouTubers that they follow, all of that. And, you know, by the end of it, this group of parents was so angry, feeling that how could their children possibly be expected to resist this stuff, because it was so brilliantly made and so engaging and funny. And one of them said, you know, that ad was the most annoying thing I've ever seen, but I know my teen would love it. So I think there's something we need to bear in mind, that there's a whole world that our young people are engaging with that we may not see in our daily lives, in a way that you'd walk past the television and see what was on and have that on your radar. So in general, what parents say, I find, is wherever you talk to them, so whether here or in other countries, it follows this same pattern. They first say, no, they know what, you know, they're teens now. They know they can make decent decisions. And in fact, what we find is that the young people themselves also will say, oh, it doesn't really affect me. But this attitude from parents and children reflects a sort of general bias that everybody has, which is that I'm in control of what I think and do, particularly in response to advertising. And you'll find the interesting thing of where both, where particularly parents say, oh, young people, no, they're not affected by social media, but they are affected by their friends. And that does obviously beg the question of, you know, where are the friends getting the ideas from? So in terms of how young people are actually affected, as I say, they feel that they're not affected, but our research with them, so we did a study across from the Dublin and Ennis with UCD, and we looked at how do children, what do they pay attention to, and we followed, so we did eye tracking studies. We looked at what do they say that they like in terms of in social media profiles. We looked at would they share. So what would they send out to their social media ecosystems? And also then what do they remember in terms of the brands that they saw? And this study showed them whole profiles that we constructed that contained ads for unhealthy foods, healthier foods, and non-food items that, you know, young people would love, just the usual consumer goods that they really adore. And consistently what we found was that they looked at ads for unhealthy foods compared to healthy foods or non-food. They looked at them longer. They said they were more likely to say they liked the look of this person who had these ads in their profile. They were more likely to share it, and they were more likely to remember the brands that they viewed if they were unhealthy brands than anything else. So sometimes when I tell people about this study, they say, well, do you know what? It probably means that they just see lots of advertising all around them for unhealthy foods. And obviously, again, back to the ecosystem idea, right? But the crucial thing to bear in mind is that even though they were compared to items that are really big ticket items that they are very attracted to, that feature celebrities they love, whether it's sports or clothes or you know, brands that they really love, they were still remembering the unhealthy foods more. And so it says something about the whole living environment that we have allowed to be created for our young people to grow up in, and leaves me asking the hard question of, you know, how have we done this and why are we still letting it happen?
Are there assumptions that regulators are making, for example, about how young people are responding that are preventing further action?
Well, you know that phrase, make healthy choices, which I think we all come out with it. I'm sure Safe Food has been known to advise that people make healthy choices. And don't we say it to our kids all the time? And there's an assumption, particularly once they reach their teens, that young people have agency, which they do, and should be developing it, which they should. But what this attitude completely underestimates is the imbalance in what's influencing children. So if I'm going to give my kids a plate of a range of junk foods and one healthy food every day for a year, and I'm going to expect them to develop a healthy eating habit, then I think I would be deluded. And that's what we're doing in terms of the advertised diet that children see. So all the cues that they get for their behavior, for their attitudes, for their preferences, for their choices, are pushing them towards that tantalizing pile of treats. And we actually want them to develop taste buds that enjoy the flavor of good, healthy food while we're serving them up endless exposure to unhealthy food prompts and cues. So I think that both parents and regulators and young people don't quite appreciate the extent to which advertising creates a world in which they live.
And can I just come back to something you said earlier about parental awareness of TV versus what's on social media?
Yeah.
Is there a difference in the way that young people respond to, let's say, an ad on TV versus an ad on social media, for example?
That's a really good question. And it's the thing that people always say when the answer is hard to come by, isn't it? We don't have direct research comparing one against the other. What we do have is enough evidence to let us know that there are ways and means by which people are advertising in social media, in which I include YouTube, that sparks young people's developing needs, as it were. So their needs for social relationships, for role models, for identity development, and all of those things. So, I mean, it's really interesting, lovely qualitative research coming out of places like Norway and the UK is telling us that young people believe that YouTubers who are featuring foods in their, in the stuff that they create, are doing it for a good reason, and that it's genuine and free of influence. And in the UK, preteens feel a particular sort of positive attitudes to the YouTubers who they like and the people they follow. And we know this also from research elsewhere on, say, music celebrities, and teens feel that it's like, here is a person who I'm in a relationship with. And I know what they love and they want, and I want to reward them for what they do. So I will buy the things that they surround themselves with, including, you know, where this happens, the food.
And Chris, if I could come back to you and talk maybe on a more legislative and policy level, can we learn anything from how other countries have tackled marketing to children?
I suppose, given that it's more than 40 years since the first restrictions were introduced in Quebec to under 13s, it's surprising, really, there's not more good examples. Mimi said it earlier, we've known for years and years that junk food marketing to children is rampant, it's fueling obesity, and that's damaging children's health. But unfortunately, the evidence and the political will have not matched up very often. Now, I suppose Chile is one example. It's possibly the best example of a country that's really seriously trying to tackle its childhood obesity problem. It brought in junk food marketing regulations on TV, radio, website, and magazines. I think it was back in 2016. And I saw some research on that that showed that this was to under 14s only now, has to be said. But I think it achieved about a 58% reduction in exposure to that age group. So in that and in other areas, Chile's excelling probably at the moment. However, I mean, if the UK can stick with its current plan and get it through all the lobbying that's going to come against it, you know, the really big forces that are going to be ranged against it. And, you know, it brings in its 9 p.m. broadcast watershed, its potential at least blanket ban on all digital marketing. And then, you know, those restrictions that we've read in the papers about on price promotions, such as buy one, get one free and end of aisle checkout placement, that sort of thing, that's going to be very significant. I mean, you know, at times we've been good here, or we've looked like we were going to be in 2005. Plan we had was well before its time. In 2013, when the broadcast regulations against it came in, they were ahead of their time. Now they've been superseded by clever industry exploitation of loopholes and that sort of thing that leads to so many young children seeing so much. I think we did some research that showed, I think, the last 2 weeks of the World Cup in 2018, in 16 matches, you could see 1,400 ads between, you know, what was there in the stadium, what was on the TV, you know, in terms of advertising. As far as we're concerned, in this country, we've fallen very far short in terms of the digital. The lesson, if we want to learn a lesson, we can learn from ourselves as well as from anywhere else, But we can learn it from around the world in any industry, from gambling to mining to anything you could think of, is that, you know, voluntary codes, they just don't work, where compliance would reduce income and profitability of the, you know, companies within the industry. They just don't work. In fairness to junk food manufacturers, you know, public health isn't their remit. Their remit is to maximize shareholder wealth. And, you know, that's what their executives are judged on. But that just shows us we've got to, it's governments that have to step up and make the decisions there. And if there's a lesson to be learned, look around the world, look at anything, and you'll see that. And that's the one lesson I'd ask our Taoiseach's office or, you know, our Department of Health to take on board, is just, we've got to develop the regulation without vested interests being involved.
Mimi, could I ask you a similar question? If you had one thing that you could do in government, what would that, I suppose, first step be?
Deep breath, a long pause. One thing. Okay, I'm going to cheat a little bit here, because my one thing would be to create an advertised diet for children. And this spans every scenario in which they are exposed to marketing. It would to be create an advertised diet for children that means that they will be exposed to ideas about food rather than junk food. What do I mean by that? I mean, that means tackling everything, though. That means tackling the on-field marketing that Chris was talking about that we saw in the World Cup, as well as the ads on TV. It means tackling the activation market, the YouTubers, the brands that create content and entertainment. It means tackling digital marketing via social media. It means tackling packaging. In Chile, I'm so delighted Chris mentioned Chile. I mean, the change in packaging in Chile has been remarkable. We've taken all the cartoon characters, whether they're licensed or whether they're brand-owned characters, they've taken them off. And it's amazing how different a package looks and how much like less for children it looks once the cartoon character is gone. You know, and for those of us who've grown up with those, it's quite shocking to see. It means taking away the marketing around schools, on buses, at bus stops, you know. And if you think that you want children to grow up in a world that says, here's healthy, enjoy it, right? Not make healthy choices while I'm pushing you the unhealthy stuff. That is my single policy ask.
Can I give you mine? I that was a lesson. I have a policy ask, if I can have it.
Absolutely.
You know, as Mimi says, it is really complex. And from all credible research we've ever seen, you know, it's only a systemic and sustained portfolio of initiatives that delivered a really big scale that can tackle this. But, you know, if there's one thing that can lead to that, there's one thing that can create that sustained action, it's political consensus and political will. You know, if we could have cross-party consensus that this is a really serious issue, it's a really serious health issue. I mean, the Safe Food Research says, the government commissioned it, so it should know what it says, that 85,000 children living on this island today will die prematurely due to overweight and obesity. You know, we know there's children aged 8 and 9 now in quite high numbers presenting with high blood pressure, and teenagers with cardiovascular age in their 60s. We need a recognition that this is a big problem, and that children will be put first in it, that it's not a matter of industry, it's not a matter of job creation, it's not a matter of wealth creation, it's a matter of children's health. Put that first, and lots of things will flow from that. You know, we say there's three prerequisites to dealing with obesity. You know, there's that political will, there's removal of vested interests from the decision-making process, and then the end of marketing of junk food to children. We say under 18s, but you could pick any age, really. If you can do that, so much will flow out of it. I mean, at the moment, what we have is really a political system that protects, you know, industry from consumers in this area rather than protects consumers, and particularly children, from industry. And, you know, they've no protection at all. I mean, Mimi's talked about the extent of the digital marketing issue, and children here have no protection and haven't had ever any protection from this. there's a fig leaf code run by the industry's own self-regulatory body that is, we would say, you know, is little more than a joke. It's not designed to protect children. It's designed to protect industry. It always leads back to that. So, as I say, if we had political consensus, and we do, I think we do, it's just how much priority is placed in it and how resistant politicians are to lobbying from industry. But if we have that children-first approach and consensus approach, we can achieve anything, really.
Thank you, Chris, for bringing this back to the central issue, which is the protection of children. So I'm going to just ask you both one last question, which is, how do we hear the voice of the child in all of this? And we've talked about the regulators, we've talked about parents, we've talked about advertisers, but where in the mix is how do children feel in all of this?
So to answer that question is a really interesting one, because I've spoken, you know, I've worked with young people and children on this. And there's a piece of work for us all to do as a community, because advertisers have had the head start. At this point, what we have is children who experience a childhood that they learn their brands before they know their ABCs, right? And their minds have been shaped by that. And so by the time they get to their teens, those brands have become intimate friends, ways to express love, ways to enjoy friendship, ways to be oppositional to parent advice that says make healthy choices. So we need to work with young people to listen to them and to understand what do the brands mean for them before we can start unpicking what effect it's having on them, and working with them to look at what that influence is. If you just go up to kids and ask them, do you think we should ban your favorite brands? That's a really naive way to go about it, and it doesn't work, as I'm sure Chris will tell you.
Chris, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with Mimi. You know, children are crucial to progress in this area. And we've got a youth advisory panel who we talk to a lot about this sort of thing. And it's really clear, you know, we asked them what they thought about this, and they thought their favorite brands were great. And we weren't going to be telling them what to think about it. Certainly, you know, when you start going underneath that and looking at the more fundamental issues around it, when you start showing young people examples of the efforts that are being made to manipulate them and how cynical it is, it makes them angry. It sort of mobilizes them a bit, you know, some more than others has to be said, but it certainly angers the young people, or has angered the young people that we've spoken to, you know, things like, you know, how brands get onto their news feeds and how they interact with them as if they're real friends, when obviously these are marketers earning money, and they couldn't give a damn about children, the children they're talking to, or the children there, or what happens to them. And we found that the children's voice in media, it gives a sort of much more authentic sort of feel to you know, to the issue. You know, these are brands that are impacting on young people's health, and it's young people saying, "Hey, we want this to stop. You know, we're being targeted here. Our health is being damaged here, and it's going to have long-term consequences. If not for, you know, the individuals who are out there talking about it, if you're exercised about it, you probably won't be, but, you know, but their peers." And it is intensely annoying, you know, certainly to the young people in our groups. We get great advice just on how to approach things, how tactically to approach things, and as well as advice, particularly on areas, you know, around, say, food in schools, you know, where it's often easier to buy a can of Coke than to get a free glass of drinking water from an old fashioned tap, you know, where children have helped us remove vending machines from their schools, how they've shown us, you know, really that there's a school environment here where they have adults talking to them in the class about what the food pyramid looks like, and they walk out of the class and the food system in the school just throws rubbish at them, you know, through tuck shops and snackeries, and, you know, selling cookies and muffins and sauce rolls, where you have, by small break, you've potentially had your recommended daily calories consumed. It's learning from young people in terms of the actual, you know, their lived experience, learning from them in what they think, and how we can have a sort of a partnership with young people where we have the same goal of saying, right, there's a huge issue here for a whole generation of children. They're being treated like corporate fodder, a little bit like 100 years ago, young people were cannon fodder. They're a little bit like corporate fodder now. You know, that annoys people and that makes people want to act. If we can work with them, give them some benefit of our own bit of experience and get their experience, I think the two working together is much more effective than just us trying to do it on our own.
Thank you, Chris. And on that very positive note, I think we will leave it there. I'd like to thank you both for your incredible contribution. It's been a privilege to have this conversation with you. Thanks for your knowledge, for your expertise and your insight. And if anyone wants to learn any more about key public health issues from our podcasts, you can listen to those wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get in touch on info@safefood.net by email, or you can follow the conversation on Twitter @SafeFoodNetwork or indeed on LinkedIn. So until the next podcast, take care and bye-bye.